are in a series of lessons on how to read the Old Testament. As I've said before, this is not a survey of the Old Testament. There's a lot of the Old Testament we're not going to look at, a lot of books that aren't going to be mentioned. But we're going to try to answer the question, how are we as Christians who are schooled in the New Testament more than the Old Testament, how are we to understand many portions of the Old Testament that are difficult or that have been kind of baptized into our New Testament culture, but in a way that causes us to ask some questions. A lot of pink elephants in the room on this subject. And one of them is the Sabbath. And I'm going to give you a test now. Some of you have been in this class and on this series for 12 sessions, so you should have a lot of answers by now. Here is your test. How would you explain this Old Testament passage? This is an inspired text from the Bible. It's even in the King James. Now, while the sons of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering wood on the Sabbath day. And later in verse 35, then the Lord said to Moses, "The man shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp." He's thrown out and stoned to death. Verse 36. So all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him to death with stones, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Now what do you do with that? Well, you're Bereans. So you basically look at what the scripture says. Well, this is part of it, but you look for more evidence. Joshua chapter 1 and verse 8. Be careful to do according to all that is written in it, that is the book of the law. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have success. In other words, your personal prosperity and success depends on how seriously you take the law of God. Exodus 31:15. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day, he shall surely be put to death. What do you do with that? Well, now you say, well, this isn't the only text we should look at. We need to look at the New Testament as well. We understand from reading Paul's letters that Christians have died to the law and been released from the law. For example, in Romans chapter 7, and there are several passages we could cite here, we read this. The law has jurisdiction over a person as long as he lives. You were made to die to the law through the body of Christ. And he's speaking here of Christian baptism. When you were baptized into Christ, you died with Christ. But now we have been released from the law, having died to that by which we were bound before. Aha, so we're set free. Now, but how do we solve the problem? Which text do we believe? And why should we believe this rather than the much more voluminous Old Testament passage or text? Thus, how do we read the Old Testament? And I'm going to suggest that the greatest challenge or the greatest issue that we face in reading the Old Testament properly is understanding the relationship between two covenants, the covenant made with Moses and the new covenant made with the blood of Christ. The covenant or the testament that is described as the Old Testament is largely based upon the Mosaic law. The new covenant, the New Testament, largely is based upon the covenant that is made with Christ, on Christ's blood, with Christ and involving the church. Lots of different ramifications for that, but that's the big conflict. And the Sabbath is one of the areas where this is going to be illustrated dramatically. The other question we'll look at next week, and that's the tithe. How do we give? How much do we give and where and for what reason? What about tithing? That's just like the Sabbath. It's a big test issue. It's not the only one. How do we view the nation Israel? Test question. it'll go on and on. Well, how do you view faith and works? What is the relationship? We'll talk about all of that, Lord willing. Three misunderstandings concerning freedom from the Mosaic Law. I'm going to repeat things here I've taught before several times, but I think it's important for us to get this straight and be reminded of it over and over again. The first misunderstanding is this, that when Paul says that we are free from the law, no longer under bondage to the law, some believe that means all moral standards are kind of off the table. That as a Christian, you're liberated, and you can do whatever you please. God will forgive you. He understands, so forth and so on. Just don't worry about it. Luther said, sin boldly. But when you read Romans chapter 6, Paul anticipates this question. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons, or one of the evidences that we have not misunderstood Paul, is that Paul understands that if you understand and follow his teaching in terms of your liberation from the law, you're going to ask this question. Paul has said, where sin abounds, grace does all the more abound. And if that's true, then you'll ask the question, well, then why not just sin it up? Why have any restrictions at all? Paul anticipates that question. He asks it and then answers it. And I'm not going to dwell on that. Your assignment this afternoon is read Romans chapter 6, where he addresses that question. The way he addresses it is very, very important. What he says is critical to understanding the significance of what he's teaching. The second misunderstanding is this, and this is one that most Christians adopt. Most say liberation from the law applies only to civil and ceremonial parts of the law. In other words, how the temple is arranged, the priest's functions. There are lots of intricate civil and ceremonial details. As a matter of fact, in the Jewish tradition, there are 613, I think, laws that are associated with the law of Moses. Not just the Ten Commandments, not just the moral part, but civil law and ceremonial law is a part of that too. And for example, lots of requirements in terms of how offerings are made, what kind of animals can be brought to sacrifice, so forth and so on. And some would argue, we're free from all of that, but we're not free from the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments abide, and we're still in bondage to them or under them. It's important for us to remember, however, that that's a convenient caveat to satisfy Western minds, but in the Hebrew tradition, the Jews never separated those things, one from the other. The law included all of those things. It was not just moral, it was ceremonial and civil, all as a unit. You have it all or you have none of it in terms of its covenant qualities. The third option is this. They suggest that liberation refers only to legalism or to the misuse of the law. In other words, Paul is not against the law so much. He's not basically separating us from the law. He's separating us from the wrong use of the law, from legalism, the way the Pharisees were using the law. Now, I think this is certainly a consideration. It's something that obviously Paul is concerned about. The challenge here is this. Paul doesn't make a distinction when he talks about the law. He doesn't spell it out as being legalism only. He assumes the law is basically the problem. And furthermore, in his argument, he says basically that Christ in his death freed us from the tyranny of the law, from the condemnation of the law. The law's purpose, he explains, was to condemn us, not to basically assure us that we're okay, but to convince us we needed someone. And if it's just a misuse of the law, then in what sense did Christ die to free us from it, from the condemnation of the law? There's something here that just doesn't fit. I'm going to suggest that there's a fourth view, and this one I think is more defensible. Freedom from the law applies only to the law as a covenant, that is, as a contract, a formal contract between God and his people, with promises of cursing and blessing based upon obedience and disobedience. The contractual power of the law is broken up. Christ's substitutionary death has satisfied all the demands of the law in terms of perfection and accomplishment. Our baptism into Christ's death has separated us from the domain of the law. We died with Christ, and for a person who is dead or deceased, the law has no power. That's Paul's argument in Romans. The law continues as a guiding light, reflecting God's holiness for God's kingdom and for his people, but not as a covenant of works righteousness. In other words, it's still not right to bear false witness. It's still not right to murder. This is consistent with the universal, eternal character of God. But we're no longer in a situation where we are automatically separated from God when we have anger in our heart. And Jesus basically equates anger as a form of murder. So when you are angry, you are not liable for capital punishment or for eternal separation from God. That's the freedom that Paul is talking about. How should Christians view the Mosaic Law? Romans chapter 10, verse 4. Christ is the end of the law of righteousness for everyone who believes. I'd summarize it this way. Christians are free from the law as a covenant of works righteousness, but not as a guide for kingdom heaven. It still is our guide. The Ten Commandments are an important rule of thumb for us, but we must put it in this context. There is a progressive revelation of God's nature and his calling on his people. Through nature, through our conscience, there's a subtle ethic. Comes from creation, conscience, and culture. It expresses the fact that God is there, and he is Lord. We may not know much about him, but he's there. We have some sense of innate consciousness of a supreme power beyond us, and he deserves respect and has authority. But it's not specific. When the Mosaic Law comes, all of that intuitive sense is codified. We have now a superficial ethic, but it's clear in terms of the Ten Commandments. These ethereal perceptions of God and holiness and what it means to be reconciled and right with him are put down in matters of rules that can be articulated and shared. When we get to Christ, we have what the apostles call the law of Christ. This is the supreme ethic. This is the living color, where the nature of God is revealed in a complex and personal way that is much more powerful, much more radiant, and much more sophisticated, much more refined than it is in the law. But it's not inconsistent with the law. It is simply basically a brighter light. It's not legalistic. It's in the heart. It's an intuitive sense of right and wrong that's expressed, that's consistent with the written law, but goes beyond that to the intention of the heart and the impulses of the heart. Christians are freed from the law, which means, unlike the Jews, they are not under the law, or they're simply looking at the code, or outside the law, like the Gentiles, who basically don't know how to articulate the impulses they have concerning right and wrong, or above the law, the libertarians, who basically says, I don't need the law, or it's the model we see initiated by Eve in the garden, where Adam and Eve see that the knowledge of good and evil will make them wise. And I interpreted the knowledge of good and evil is the right to define what's right and wrong, the right to play God in terms of what the rules might be. We live in a culture where there are a lot of people who want to define what's right and wrong. What seems right to me and wrong to me, that's the rules that I live by. You can't tell me what to do. That's a libertarian philosophy, and it basically has its roots in the very fall of mankind. Freedom from the law means that basically we are out from under the tutorial role of the law. Now, I'll illustrate it this way. The law is like training wheels on a bike. Unfortunately, when I learned to ride a bike, I didn't have training wheels. But my parents had Band-Aids. And I didn't have a little bike either. I started with a big bike. And it was, I can still remember those torturous, scary experiences. But our children started with training wheels. But it wasn't long, and the training wheels no longer were necessary. After it has done its job, a skilled rider is free to fall off, but is not expected to. In other words, our kids, after they shed the training wheels, they had accidents. They didn't have to, and it was not expected that they would, but they could, and it wasn't going to be the end of the world for their expectations or for their consequences, hopefully. This is a crude illustration, but it makes the point. Christians do not have to be sinless to be loved by God, to be redeemed by God. But they are saved by faith for the purpose of doing good works, riding the bike well. The law basically showed us basically what that meant and got us started. But it's not something we should be clinging to after we learn its lessons. Put it this way. Our relationship with God is based on faith, not the works of the law. Saving faith should lead to works of faith, but it is not the basis, or it's not basic, based on those works. It doesn't require those works in order to be valid. Okay, how does our freedom from the law relate to keeping the Sabbath? That's what we're going to be talking about today. First of all, the Sabbath law started with Moses. Now, the Sabbath didn't start with Moses. The Sabbath law started with Moses. The Sabbath existed from all creation. It's mentioned in the creation account. But we do not know exactly when it started as a practice among God's people. We know that with Moses, it was codified as a law. Then you came down from Mount Sinai and spoke with them from heaven. You gave them, speaking to Moses, you gave them just ordinances and true laws, good statutes and commandments. So you made known to them your holy Sabbath and laid down for them commandments, statutes, and laws through your servant Moses. When God speaks to Israel with these words, he equates the Sabbath, the fourth commandment, with the law generally. This is not insignificant. The point here is Moses initiated the Sabbath as a part of the law system and covenant. Now, again, just review something. 2 or 3 weeks ago, we looked at the basic redemptive covenants in the Old Testament and noted that the structure of the Old Testament is the modus operandi, the method of operation in a relationship between God and man. The Mosaic Law became a central focus for Israel's culture. Of all the commandments, the promise of Abraham issued in the covenant of the law with Moses. The Sabbath is at the heart of the Mosaic Law. It became the symbol of the law. It wasn't necessarily the greatest law or the most significant law, but it was basically at the center of it. If you ask most Jewish people, what does it mean to obey God? It starts with the Sabbath, honoring the Sabbath. We can go back to the fact that the Sabbath was given to Israel as a sign along with the law. He says this, for example, in Exodus chapter 31. You shall surely observe my Sabbaths, for this is a sign between me and you throughout your generation, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you, or sets you apart. The Sabbath will mark you as distinct in the world. The seventh day, the creation, was always appreciated, But the law of the Sabbath is something that sets God's people apart in terms of their observance of that special day. Sabbath is the only day in the creation story that was blessed by God. The creation was blessed, but the special blessing of each of the commandments comes and rests on the Sabbath. The Sabbath was the day of creation that was blessed. Even the day of the creation of man, the sixth day, was not blessed. The Sabbath was. The creation narrative in Genesis 1 and 2 basically follows a progressive order, starting with the most basic things, light and darkness, and ending with the creation of man. Or not really ending there, there's a seventh day, it's the Sabbath. And many Jewish commentators view the Sabbath as the primary point of the creation story. Some would go so far as to say the whole creation narrative is given to us for one purpose, not to explain the science of creation. It's to basically show the significance of the Sabbath, show us the priority of the Sabbath, basically to make Torah and Sabbath what the whole ball game is about. I'm not saying every Jewish rabbi basically would teach that, but this was a common, and is, I believe, a common understanding in many Jewish circles. Sabbath commemorates rest from creation and bondage in Egypt. These two passages will help us understand that. Exodus chapter 20. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord, your God. In it you shall not do any work. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth. And here the parallel is with the creation account in Genesis and the seventh day in terms of the day of worship. By the way, the Sabbath is Saturday here. There's no indication in the Old Testament or the New Testament, as we're going to see, that the Sabbath ever became Sunday. That's a sacred cow that basically we're going to starve. They'll never kill, but we'll try to starve it out. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, he says in Deuteronomy chapter 5. And the Lord your God brought you out there by a mighty hand and by an outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord your God commanded you to observe the Sabbath day. And here he links the Sabbath with the rest that the people of Israel had as a result of being delivered from bondage. So there are two streams that lead into the meaning of the Sabbath. One is it's a picture of God's resting as a result of his creative work, and it's of Israel's resting as a result of their bondage, or freedom from their bondage. It's a very serious issue, starting with the passage we looked at in terms of what do you do with this. For 6 days, you may work may be done, but on the seventh day, you shall have a holy day, Sabbath of complete rest to the Lord. Whoever does not work on it shall be put to death. I mean, this is repeated in many different places in the Old Testament, especially in the Torah. Two views of basically when or what constitutes the right day. The Sabbath as Saturday. This is the Jewish position as outlined in the Old Testament. It is also a position of a small number of Adventists in the Christian tradition, but a very small group. But by the way, they're right with regard to the day. There, as I've said before, there is no indication that I can find that Sunday was ever treated as a Old Testament Sabbath day. The view that's most popular with Christians is to make Sunday as the Lord's day and call it a Sabbath or treat it as a Sabbath. This is the predominant Christian view and the predominant Christian tradition. This reflects the worship pattern of the early church and of the contemporary church, the church today, by and large. This gives testimony and support to the continuity of the Old and New Covenants. Now, at this point, we might conclude that what Paul is saying and what I've been echoing in terms of a radical disjuncture between the old covenant, the law, and the new covenant by the Holy Spirit through Christ's blood constitute two different systems. But this would suggest that the two systems really may have different names, but they're the same system. It would suggest continuity. But it's not the only thing that would suggest that. When I was an undergraduate, my major was architecture. And one of the things we studied in our architectural history class was the history of how architecture reflects culture. And one of the interesting things that was noted was the fact that Christian churches were organized a lot like the Jewish temple and the tabernacle. Three different sections. There was a place where the congregation gathered. It was a place where the priests or clergy administered. And then there was the altar, or basically the holy place where certain ceremonies took place. Now, if you're a Baptist, you don't know what this is talking about here. But if you're an Anglican or Catholic or a Lutheran or a High Presbyterian, if you look at any of the great cathedrals in Europe, you will recognize the architecture. But it's not just architecture. Assumptions made by the Puritans, early forefounders of America, who were devout Christians, had a view of the Sabbath that was very close to this. And many evangelical Christians hold in high esteem the Puritan doctrine of the Sabbath. The Sabbath law of the Mosaic Covenant were applicable to the Christians, it was believed. Sunday was the Christian Sabbath. Labor and even recreation were not permitted on the Sabbath. In other words, in Isaiah 58, the passage says, Sabbath is not a place for you to do the things you want to do. It should be a place where you basically are disciplined to do what honors the Lord, not necessarily what you wish to do. You're not free to do your own thing. And they say that includes recreation. Now, there's a debate. And many of us have yawned and moved on to touch football or watching football on television or something that's recreational. I'm not going to debate that. Certain acts of ministry were permitted on the Sabbath. Keeping the Sabbath did not bring salvation, but it did bear witness to one's identity as a Christian and brought blessing and judgment, just as the Old Testament covenant Sabbath did to Israel. In other words, you don't honor the Sabbath, God's going to do something about that to you, and it's not going to be good. You honor the Sabbath, and you're faithful in doing that, you're going to be rewarded. And it's not just the physical, emotional rest that comes from a day of rest. It's the fact that you're doing it unto the Lord, and He's going to bless you in your work. That is the assumption that many Puritans had, most Puritans had, many evangelicals today still have that impression. Historical Christian culture basically bears witness to the union of Sunday and the Sabbath, to the Old Covenant and to the New Covenant. Not just the architecture, I mentioned that, but altar sacrifices. Now, in the Catholic Church, the Mass is a sacrifice. In the Lutheran Church, there is no sacrifice, but there is an altar. I can remember as a small boy in the Lutheran Church, we could play when the church service wasn't going on. We could play in the pews, but you didn't go behind the altar. That's scary, because God's back there someplace. When you got close to that, you talked quiet, and you're very careful not to get too close. Now, of course, that made no theological sense, even to Luther. But when you're a young boy, it's made to look that way. I can remember the first time that I saw the large cathedral in Amsterdam at Haarlem. I can't remember the name of the cathedral. Huge, huge Cathedral. The thing that impressed me was when you enter that building, the impact of the architecture, you felt so small. And that's exactly what the architect wanted. When you entered there, every step was clink, echoed, clink, echoed. And the windows were oversized, the doors were oversized, the ceiling was huge, stone everywhere, dark gray. You felt very small. And the closer you got to the front of the building, the more awesome it became. And everything was fenced off because the laity were not allowed to go to the place where the sacrifices took place in that Christian tradition. You get a small taste of that at Duke Chapel, but a very small taste. It's not like cathedrals of Europe. But the point is, there is a parallel between the architecture and the structure of buildings in history, church history, and the Old Testament. Priestly dress and liturgy. In the Lutheran church where I grew up, the pastor always wore a robe when he conducted the service. In the same way, the priests of the Old Testament had a special dress that they adorned themselves with. The Law and the Ten Commandments. They were honored in both. Copies of the Ten Commandments were the first thing you memorize in Sunday school. In the church where I grew up, the Ten Commandments in the Lord's Prayer. Holy days, places, and events. To this day, I'm amazed at how many evangelical Christians really believe that sacred places come with a sacramental quality. When you go to Jerusalem, there's something sacred about this place, that you're going to meet God there in a way you wouldn't meet him in Siler City. You know, it's just, there's something sacred about it. How many slivers of the cross, of the real cross, have been circulated throughout history? Enough to build huge, huge buildings. But the Crusaders had a sliver of the cross on their shield to basically guarantee they'd be victorious in war. Didn't work very well for them. But the point is, we have this idea that there are some places, some events, and some days that really have a special sacramental power connected with them. That's not just a part of Judaism, it's a part of Christianity as well. And then we have the Sabbath and Sunday, that special day. This seems to offer strong support for the continuity of the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. Or does it? Let me spoil that parade real quick by asking you one question. After Pentecost, where do you see any reference to any of this? Zip. The apostles of the New Testament, the New Testament church, spoke nothing about buildings and robes and liturgy, said nothing about what they did say about the Sabbath, we're going to look at it in a bit, and Sunday, didn't fit the pattern. And about sacred objects. I mean, there is no sense in which, as close as they were in time dimensions to the crucifixion of Christ, there is no sense of going back to Jerusalem and visiting the site where Christ was crucified or where the church got started. It's not mentioned. The Shroud of Turin. I mean, they were close enough to it. They could probably get something like that. We get excited about that. But for what reason? Is it just because of archaeology? For some people, it's more than that. This is sacred. And the question we must ask, if we're Bereans, is where does that come from? Well, it comes from traditions, but it's really pretty hard to find substantiation from that from the New Testament. So I would argue that quite the contrary to what tradition would suggest, the fact that these things are not just downplayed, they're not mentioned in the teaching of the apostles to the early church, says something. Sometimes what's not said is more powerful and louder than what is said. There's a third view in terms of what the Sabbath really means. And I'm going to suggest it has little or nothing to do with a day. After Pentecost, the teaching of the apostles links the Sabbath to faith in our work. Faith and peace. I'll call it the spiritual Sabbath. This is suggested in Hebrews, Romans, and Colossians, and hinted at in other places. Why did Jesus taunt the Pharisees when he did not have to do so in Mark chapter 2? This is a passage that often comes up. The Pharisees, the Jesus' disciples were walking through the countryside and picking ears from grain to eat on the Sabbath. And that got them in lots of trouble. They didn't have to do that. They weren't starving to death. But this is the kind of thing that Jesus seemed to do almost tauntingly to the Pharisees. And the Pharisees said to them, to him, to Jesus, "See here, why are they doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath?" And he was saying to them, "The Sabbath is made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man," or the Son of Man, "is Lord even of the Sabbath." Now this statement was more dramatic when it was first heard by the Pharisees than it is for us today. No Hebrew prophet would have ever made this bold claim in regard to the Sabbath. People say Jesus was misunderstood because he never really was God, never really was Messiah even. Some people thought he was Messiah, they made him God, but when you look at Jesus' teaching, he was just a Hebrew prophet that was misunderstood. He was basically trying to reform Judaism. No Hebrew prophet would ever get by with saying this. If this is what Jesus said, and the text is not really in question, it would imply that he's something more than a prophet. This is one occasion where Jesus reveals his authority and identity as a divine messianic figure. It wasn't the only place. But here, basically, all of a sudden, the lights come on. And people get a picture, if they're listening, of who this man really is. He's not just a prophet. Or it may be a hint even of a coming challenge to the old system, to the old covenant and the foretaste of a new covenant that Paul basically reveals. On the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread, Paul began talking to them, intending to leave the next day, prolonging his message until midnight. Long sermon. And it wasn't necessarily terribly exciting because some people fell asleep, we're told. There's no question the early church met for worship, for teaching, for ministry on the first day of the week, commemorating the finished work on the cross and the resurrection. But there's no indication that this was treated as a Sabbath. When the Sabbath is mentioned, it basically is spoken of in different terms, which you're going to see in a moment. The early church met on the first day of the week, Sunday, out of respect for the finished work of Christ, and perhaps as a sign of a new covenant. It doesn't explain it this way, but it makes sense. The spiritual Sabbath basically starts with the Sabbath day being tied to the law of Moses. That is, the day is tied to the law of Moses. As a day, it was assigned to Israel only. It was not given to the world. As a matter of fact, it was given to Israel so Israel would be different than the world. It would mark Israel as being distinct. They had the Sabbath law. Jesus challenged the Sabbath law tradition while honoring the spirit of the Sabbath, as we're going to see. The change in days of worship mirrored a change in covenants. I'm just simply suggesting that, because it fits. The Mosaic law had ceased as a covenant. The law still had usefulness in terms of telling us something about the character of God and what it meant to be living in his kingdom. But it was no longer a contract that had the power to condemn. The sting was taken away. The sting of death was taken away because of the law, which brought condemnation for those who broke it, or rewards for those who kept it. That was off the table with the covenant aspect of the law. Paul advocated freedom with respect to Sabbath days, with the emphasis here being on days. We're going to see that in a moment. The true Sabbath is a life of faith in God's work for us in Christ. And it's a peace that we bring to our work, as I'm going to express in a moment. The point of the Sabbath is not ceasing to work on the Sabbath. It's bringing the Sabbath to your work. It's basically carrying the rest and peace of God that comes with faith in Him to everything we do. How do you honor the Sabbath? I'm going to argue you honor the Sabbath by what you do before you go to church and after you go back from church. And if you're worried about what you're going to do today and what doesn't get done, or being late, or not being there, or what are people going to think, or all that stuff, you're not honoring the Sabbath. I don't care how loudly you sing, how high your hands go, and how excited you get about the music in the sermon. That's immaterial. You celebrate the Sabbath when your life faces the obstacles, the high inside fast pitches of life, with peace and contentment, with rest in your soul. There's a reason Paul begins his letters with "grace and peace be unto you." And he says that at the end of his letters often as well. Why would he say that? Maybe he understood the Sabbath and its significance. Of the Ten Commandments, the fourth is the only one not notarized in the epistles. The epistles talk about not committing murder. They emphasize telling the truth. They basically are concerned about basically being content with what you have, not wanting someone else's stuff. But the Sabbath is the one thing that is not reiterated as a day of special significance. Hebrews chapter 4. "Therefore let us fear," the author of Hebrews says, "lest while a promise remains of entering his rest, any one of you should seem to have come short of it. For we who have believed enter the rest," that rest. "For if Joshua," and here he's speaking of Joshua in the promised land, "if Joshua had given them rest," the people of Israel, "rest, he would not have spoken of another day after that. There remains, therefore, a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For the one who has entered his rest has himself also rested from his work, as God did from his. Let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall through following the same example of disobedience." And he goes on, and in just a moment. The issue is not, as I've said, do we work on the Sabbath, but rather, do we bring the Sabbath rest to our work? Romans chapter 14. This is why Paul would say this. "One man regards one day above another. Another regards every day alike. Let each man be fully convinced in his own mind. He who observes one day observes it to the Lord, for the Lord. And he who eats does so for the Lord, for he gives thanks to God. And he who eats not, for the Lord he does not eat, and gives thanks to God. For not one of us lives for himself, and not one of dies for himself." And here he's speaking of sincere Christians who basically were debating over whether or not the Sabbath should be followed, i.e. the pattern of the Old Testament. And he's saying, listen, let everyone be persuaded in your own mind. But the differences you have, be tolerant in respect to them. Therefore, do not let anyone judge you by what you eat or drink, or with regard to religious festivals, a new moon celebration, or a Sabbath day. In other words, if you're an Adventist, fine. If you're worshiping God in that context, great. If you're not, if you have Monday as a special day of worship, don't be critical of that. be rather concerned about, are you living a life that is a sabbatical or a Sabbath-oriented orientation toward life? That's the real issue. Paul's favorite salutation, as I've mentioned, is grace to you and peace. What does this suggest? I'm going to suggest that it is very close to the Old Testament expression that the Jews would use with regard to the Sabbath. We'll get to it in a moment. The Sabbath is all about the affirmation of what is finished in our life. Not just the creation, but our striving, our identity, our redemption. All these things are over now. It's done. We're not doing them. They're done. And we live lives as though it's all done. That doesn't mean we don't have anything to do, but it means we're doing it as frosting on the cake, so to speak. We're doing it basically out of a context of having been filled. We're off the hook. We're free. We are no longer striving to gain something that we don't have. We already have the things we really need. In Jewish tradition, Shabbat, Shalom. What does that mean? Sabbath, peace. Sabbath, rest. And as I understand it, that is a common salutation, a common greeting in Hebrew tradition. Again, Sabbath, rest. Sabbath, peace. Every day in the Jewish tradition, the Sabbath reminds the Jewish people, this is the way life should be lived. Here's the way I'd translate that. Cool it. Let anxiety die with the law. Let fear die with the law. Let your peace reign with Christ's resurrection and your resurrection with him. That's the point of the Sabbath. Okay, now we can talk.
Jim,
yes?
Can I play cards on Sunday?
Yes, as long as it's Rook.
Yeah. Outside of Judaism, was there a tradition of a day of rest?
The question is, outside of Judaism, was there a tradition of a day of rest? Good question, and I do not have a confident answer in that. My sense is that the Sabbath tradition as a Sabbath was unique to Israel. Although I think let me look at that, because that's a very, very good question. I don't know how to answer to it, but my sense is it was unique to Israel.
I think it was Cambodia during their revolution. They tried to change the day of rest from the seventh day to the tenth day to be more efficient.
Yeah.
It didn't go over very well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the tradition, the Christian tradition, the biblical tradition has infiltrated a lot of cultures that aren't Christian or Jewish. The impact has been dramatic, primarily through the prosperity and that the biblical worldview has brought to humanity, and it's been exported to the world politically. Anyway, yes.
In follow up to his question, I wonder if there were any religious festivals or senses of God bestowing peace upon people, per se, without any regard to any kind of work. Because, I mean, God's call to Israel, my understanding is his call to Sabbath rest, peace, apart from you've done enough work, now you can rest.
And I
don't know if there were any other gods that bestowed rest, bestowed peace, or was the Jewish God
not that I know of. I'm not aware of any religious tradition that has anything quite like that. This, but I may be wrong, because there are a lot of things I don't know about. Yes.
It seems like the Muslim tradition has a lot of.
The Muslim tradition has a taproot that goes into the biblical history, And there are a lot of overlap there, but there are a lot of distinctions too. It departs liberally in several places. But it does have the same creation narrative largely as well.
Pray X amount of times a day.
Yes.
That would seem to be a kind of a similar emphasis.
Yeah, there are many religions that have sacred days that are not unlike sacred days in Israel, in Judaism. Yes.
It's really extremely exciting. I've never really experienced quite before this relationship between God as portrayed in the Old Testament and Christ, and the relationship between Christ and God, and how mankind can and has now opened after Christ appears to take a very spiritual as opposed to a very
material
formalistic path.
Yeah.
Truly exciting.
Well, this what Dorothy is saying, this she was struck by the way in which, when you get past Pentecost, the relationship with God becomes personal and intimate in a way in which it is only formal and distant in the Old Covenant. And that's an accurate observation, and I think a powerful observation. But shouldn't be surprising. When you read Jeremiah 31, where there's a prophecy of the coming new covenant, part of that prophecy says that God would write the law on the hearts of his people. They would no longer have to teach one another the statutes and memorize and look at the book and say, is this lawful or not? There is going to be something of Christ or God's Spirit in them that would guide them. Now, let me just depart there for a minute and make a little sermon, one of my hobby horses. One of the things that concerns me about many of my Christian friends, and was something that concerned me about myself, was a tendency in the culture in which I grew up, the Christian culture in which I grew up, there was this tradition of seeking God's will by looking for some kind of sign. Do you want me to go to Duke or to Carolina or State? Do you want me to move or stay here? Do you want me basically to wear this or that or whatever it might be? And wait for God to speak concerning what is his will for me. That seems very old covenant. When I stop and think about it, what Pentecost meant and what the prophecy of Jeremiah meant is that it's almost as though the Spirit is saying, listen, Jim, you've already got what you need to make that decision. Now, basically, do the math in your mind, in your heart, and make the decision. You don't have to ask me for revelation. I've already given you the revelation, and I've given you the Spirit. Speak to yourself. Don't let yourself, or don't, as I've said in a previous class, don't listen to your flesh. Talk to yourself in terms of what you know from the things of God. And then make a good, wise decision. And if it's not the best decision, then you learn from it. That same Spirit is going to be there to guide you and pick you up. And he's going to guide you not by basically all of a sudden the clouds are going to form and there's going to be a writing in the sky, or someone's going to say something, you're going to find a verse that speaks to you. It's going to be the math that Spirit basically works in your mind and in your heart. You're going to be able to see and learn from your experiences and become wise. Now, I say that because that seems to be the way the early church made decisions. In the controversy in the church in Acts chapter 15 over how do we include the Gentiles, the apostles got together and they talked about it. They didn't talk. It says they argued, they debated, they fought over it. And they finally decided this is the will of God. They could have very easily all got on their hands and knees and said, Lord, rain from heaven the truth on this issue and we'll receive it. They didn't do that.
One time they threw dice.
Well, that was before Pentecost. Yeah, but that's very Old Testament, is throwing dice. And I'm not saying that God can't break into our lives with special revelation. But that isn't normally what he does. he normally says, basically, the training wheels are off. You can ride. Now ride. That's why we're told to walk in the Spirit, not rest in the Spirit, in the sense of waiting for God to do something. You walk in the Spirit. You take steps. You have to take the steps. You make the decisions. Okay.
So, like, how can you do that? Because almost every passage,
yeah,
right after the blessing was a curse,
right,
and I think that
has
kind of
on
a low level bothered me all of my
life. The question that you're raising is a good one. When you read the Old Testament, we love the blessings. We don't read the curses. Deuteronomy 28 is a good passage to read if you're a prosperity preacher. It'll give you lots of ammunition. But be sure to read the curses as well as the blessings, because you're right. The curses don't get mentioned. Next week, when we talk about tithing, I mean, we'll talk a lot more about material, the material emphasis in the Old Testament. Yes?
Can you comment on any of the extended breasts of the Old Testament? Like the Sabbath?
Oh, you mean other Sabbaths?
Yeah
well, there are several days. Special days basically were granted Sabbath status, and therefore the laws applied to them. There are certain things you just couldn't do on special days. But they were not the weekly Sabbath. The weekly Sabbath was included in that group, but it was not exclusively the Saturdays.
So like the year of
Jubilee? Yeah. Well, I don't know of any place where the year of Jubilee is called a Sabbath year. I may have missed that, but I am not familiar with that. Next week we'll talk about the whole relationship of God's people in the Old Testament with material things, i.e. the tithe, the year of Jubilee, so forth and so on. We'll talk about that. Yes.
Sunday, everything was closed.
Yes. You can thank the Puritans for that.
But particularly in the South, there were also loopholes.
Yeah.
Where you could get around.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
How did you handle the Sabbath?
The question is, how do Jews handle the Sabbath today? It depends on whether you're Orthodox, Reformed, or conservative. The Orthodox and conservative are very strict. Orthodox especially, you don't ride a trolley car or subway on the Sabbath in New York, because it's basically you're participating in the work of the burning of the fuel.
They still sell ovens that are designed so you can program it so they go on the day of the Sabbath, so you're not doing the work.
Yeah, there are ways of wiring around. The Pharisees could do that.
There's somebody in the church who went on a cruise, and there were a lot of Jews on the cruise, and on the Sabbath, they had a crew member stationed at the elevator, and they would press the buttons for them so they could ride.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. And God was pleased. Yes.
What day is
I'm sorry?
What day is their Sabbath?
Saturday.
So they still...
Yeah, Friday night till Saturday night.
Okay.
Starts at Friday.
As far as you can go back and look, when was the tradition from Saturday to Sunday started?
When did the Sunday Sabbath start? That started quite early, the Sunday as a Sabbath. That started quite early, but I don't know the exact date. But I think beginning in the New Testament, where the church is gathered on the Lord's Day in commemorance of Christ's resurrection, as early as that, even though it's not mentioned as a Sabbath, it probably was treated as the day of gathering and worship, much in the same way that those who are Jewish remembered it.
So first Christians, first century Christians?
We don't know for sure. I don't know for sure, but it's very early. First and second century, the Sunday was seen as the Sabbath.
So, Jim, most of the early Christians were Jews. So you,
yes. Well, they got Paul's letters, and I think pretty early. Paul's letters were written before the Gospels were written. And I think the controversy concerning Jews and Gentiles in the book of Acts was a big issue in the early church. What do we do with Gentiles? Do they have to become Jews before they can be Christians? And the apostle said, no, they don't. Peter and Paul disagreed about that until Acts chapter 15, where they worked it out after a fight. Yes?
So, the overarching, what you're proposing is how do we, as under the new covenant, deal with the law?
Yeah.
And you had said that we're free from the law, but not from its kingdom ethics.
We're free from the law as a covenant.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Well, I'll put it this way. All the laws, basically, we died to. They no longer have power over us. The ethical laws, the Ten Commandments, basically, are reiterated not as the Ten Commandments, but they're reiterated as principles or mandates for kingdom living after Pentecost. When you read Paul's letters, I mean, he's not arguing for lying. You're not free to lie. I mean, you can do it, but basically, if you're a Christian, basically this is inconsistent with who you are. Being true to yourself means you're going to basically pretty much behave in this way. The Sabbath is the one thing that he explains differently. He doesn't mention a special day. Yes. Right. He fulfilled them as a covenant, so that the burden is not on our back to basically redeem ourselves by fulfilling the law. That's been done for us. Yes?
I started coming back to God in my life when I read the book None of These Diseases and recognized how the Bible really outlined a lot of the laws, a lot of the stipulations
right.
about eating really had some value that we recognize now scientifically.
Yes, there's a lot of things in the Old Testament that make scientific sense in terms of what kind of food you eat, so forth and so on. But we have to be very careful and recognize that's not consistent through everything. When it fits, it fits, and we parade, we hoist the flag. It's like answered prayers. When we basically give testimonies to answered prayer, we've got lots of examples. We conveniently ignore the many times when our prayers weren't answered. And that's human nature. Yes?
So Hebrews 10, 24 and 25 is a verse that you kind of learned earlier.
Yeah.
Meeting together.
Right. Right.
So that's basically what we're doing today. Is the reason yeah. we come together is to encourage one another.
Right.
To honor the Lord. To
there's no question in the New Testament epistles, the apostles are very concerned about Christians not being isolated. Mm-hmm. We basically are one another with one another, mm-hmm. and we are a lot of one another stuff, a lot of community stuff. A lot of we as opposed to me. Actually, it's me, we, and he. With less of me, more of we and he in terms of our life. And that includes meeting together, working together, sharing our lives together, so forth and so on. Yes?
Second is like it.
Yeah.
Love your neighbor as yourself. So that has that he and then that we component.
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
I'm very new to the Bible, so if I say something kind of weird, please excuse me. But the message that I've really been getting is the body of Christ. I think, I'm not sure whether I'm supposed to say Paul, which, you know, because I'm trying to read some of the things, but the body of Christ, meaning all the people that have faith in Jesus Christ, I think the Lord has kind of told us we are part of something, even in our, you know, on earth.
Yeah.
Here, something much larger than just ourselves, even though each one of us is responsible for our own salvation. And I think that's why I'm very drawn to this church, you know, is because community is what strengthens you against the world. Because, as you know, we all know, assault on everything practically today is happening all around us. And the strength is actually in the Lord, but in tangible terms, each other.
Paul makes a big deal in the Corinthians letters, especially, a church that was prone to be individualistic, all about me, and each of the me's had their own criteria, to emphasize the we aspect. We are members of one another, he says, and in 1 Corinthians. And we basically together make up the body of Christ. We don't all have the same gifts, but we need all the gifts. There are things that I can do that other people can't do. There are people that other people do I can't do. And that's true of all of us. And we need one another to fulfill the image of God, in a sense. And if we're not connected in some meaningful way, we lose. We suffer from that. I'm amazed, for example, there's some people who have an ability to spend their life, young people, spend their life with elderly people they don't know in hospice and at a time when an elderly person is dying. And they seem like they're made for this. I marvel at that. I marvel at the fact that there are caretakers for our son, who is in his 40s now and profoundly autistic, that basically they're paid for doing what they're doing, but they do it anyway. They just really enjoy caring for people in need like that. And they look at me and say, how in the world can you stand up in front of people and talk for an hour and a half? I mean, you'd never get me to do that, you know. It's the point is, we need one another. And I think we need to be reminded of that and celebrate that. Yes?
Is there any sense, since you brought the Corinthians letters, is there any sense that Paul is saying this for the sake of the church because of the addition of the Gentiles? Or is there just, do you get a sense that he just has a general sense of, even if it was just a Jewish church, y'all need to learn how to work together?
Right.
What's your thought?
It's the same thing. There's no neither Jew nor Greek in the body of Christ, male or female, slave or free. The poor and the rich, men and women, people from ethnic backgrounds, racial backgrounds. As a matter of fact, it's the fact that those things no longer matter. But they are there. We recognize them. They no longer matter. What matters is the we and the he. And that's what we're about. And we'll see you next week. We'll talk about the Sabbath.